Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, hello, welcome. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby. God, I feel weird singing that, even after 6 years. It's just bizarre. You know, I think some of you don't know that that's a song, like from the 80s. Anyway, I'm just flying off the seat of my pants today. I am so excited to be bringing you all a conversation with Dr. Nadira Hill. I met Nadira, I realized, first in Athens, though I think we barely met, but we did. And then again in Vancouver when we were together for a Peopling the Past colloquium, which was so much fun and introduced me to so many brilliant people. And anyway, we went out for drinks after and Nadira was like, I studied drinking culture in ancient Greece. And I was like, excuse you? And anyway, that's what Nadira is here to talk about today. We talked about just drinking broadly in ancient Greece, wine culture, the like nitty gritty on I mean, honestly, everything. Nadira went into the realities of like just homes in ancient Greece because she has worked on archaeological sites, just excavating homes, like utterly fascinating daily life type stuff. Plus, you know, what the ancient Greeks drank, what they didn't drink or might not have drank, as it will come to pass. I am so obsessed with ancient Greek drinking vessels that it was also a chance for me to ask as many questions as possible about what we know or don't know about those and kind of how common they were in the everyday home. We had such a fun conversation. I think it's just perfect for this time of year. Like, let's look back at 2,500 years of boozing it up. You know, the ancient Greeks, they loved their wine. That's what comes out of this episode. And I'm really excited for you all to hear it. Let's get right into it. Conversations, wandering through wine culture, ancient Greek drinking with Dr. Nadira Hill. In my my notes, I just kind of was like, we're talking about drinking, which was just so exciting enough. So you, like, what about this kind of, like, drinking culture did you study? I don't know if it's something that you're still working on or you just, like, have done a lot on it. But yeah, like, what about it and, like, what interests you? Like, I love all that shit. Yeah. Ancient Greek and their obsession with wine / whatever else. I'm down.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question to start with. And honestly, not something I have ever been asked before, which is strange. But I don't really talk about my work very much, which is also very strange to me, because, you know, I spent 7 years writing this dissertation about it and have never, but very rarely talk about my work, because I'm all, you know, I'm doing other things that I think interest people a little bit more and kind of eclipses my work. But anyway,
People are wrong. I'm just like, literally, I don't even remember how it came up, but you just like told me something about drinking and I was like, oh my god, please come on this show and talk about it, like, yeah, that's so fun.
Yeah. And yeah, funny enough, like when we met, right, I was not talking about my research. No. I was talking about the other things that I do. But back to your question, I guess, so the thing that I really interested me initially, right, is the symposium, right, the Greek symposium, the all-male drinking party with a bunch of asterisks after it, like that was what I was really interested in from, like, I mean, basically the beginning of my graduate career, my graduate program at Michigan. I was really interested in that. I kept seeing it everywhere. I kept reading about it. And then at a certain point, I don't know when exactly it happened, I realized that that's all I ever read about was, like, that's all I ever saw when it came to Greek drinking was the symposium. And I was like, okay, but, like, what about all the other people that obviously lived in Greece at the same time? And I wanted to know more about that, but I wasn't seeing a lot of scholarship or anyone really talking about that subject. Sometimes I would see people talking about, like, drinking in public spaces, like taverns and bars and brothels and things like that. But I never saw it in the private space of the house, of the Greek house. So since I started working on projects that concerned Greek houses, I was like, okay, like, someone needs to figure out what's going on with all of the other people. Like, how are other people drinking besides these men, these elite men, especially, like, the symposium cannot have been the only place where anyone was drinking. And so that's kind of where I began, my interest began. And I decided that I was going to figure it out. I was going to figure out how other people were drinking, where. I guess the rest is history. I wrote an entire dissertation on it.
No, I love that. And, like, I think that's the story of so much of ancient Greece, right? Is like, but what about people who weren't rich, elite, and in Athens? Like, what about literally everyone else? Because I don't know enough about the symposium, but, like, I imagine it's predominantly Athenian. And in terms of, like, our sourcing, it's predominantly Athenian, like, so many things. And yeah, like, I mean, I can only imagine, like, literally everyone else existed. Like, what were they doing? We know everyone drank wine more than, like, almost anything else. So, like, yeah, what was kind of going on there? I did, like, some really basic research into drinking before I wrote little bits of my cocktail book for obvious reasons. And there was, so it was hard to find a lot of stuff. And so I focused a lot on talking about symposia because, like, that's what I could find as just, like, little old me who also, you know, had to write a cocktail book in a month. So, like, you know, there wasn't much to be easily found on my end. So I'm glad to hear other people have also wondered that, like, I'm trying to even think of, like, what to ask because I just kind of want to know everything. But I mean, like, drinking vessels have always really interested me, but they also feel like something that is, like, very linked to symposia because they're so fancy. And, like, I imagine people had, you know, lots of different types of drinking vessels, but the stuff we think of, like the really richly decorated, like, kylikes and cantharoi and stuff, like, were regular people drinking from fancy shit all the time? Like, did they have their own stuff? Like, what do we know?
Yeah, that's definitely something that I kind of addressed in my dissertation because I really love pottery. And funny enough, at the beginning of writing my dissertation and doing my research, I was very much against looking at the decorated pottery, because I was like, I don't care about that. I only care about like the very technical aspects of pottery production. Like, I don't care about decoration. I don't want to talk about that. And then, of course, I wrote an entire chapter on decorated pottery. So I definitely looked at the different shapes and the different decoration, because, you know, of course, not all Greek pottery, especially drinking pottery, was decorated in like the richly like red figured vases that we tend to associate with the Symposium. Like, those shapes were also, a lot of those shapes were produced, especially in the 4th century, in black gloss. So I consider those to be like a plainer version of the more richly decorated ones. And then I didn't really get into like plain, undecorated wares, but like there are definitely other shapes that were produced in plainware that were undecorated that may have been used for drinking, because, you know, with everything in the Greek world, like, they probably had multiple uses, right? Even though they may resemble things that, like, for example, we might call it something, a bowl. It could have been used also for drinking. So trying to kind of broaden our perspective of what was used in these contexts, but also thinking more broadly about where these drinking cups that we tend to associate with the Symposium or any wine-related shape, like craters and mixing bowls and serving vessels, that tend to be closely associated with the Symposium, the formal Symposium. And what I tried to do is like look at their distribution more broadly across houses and spaces in Athens and at Olynthos in northern Greece, to really think about, you know, is there really a very specific correlation between the Greek Symposium and these shapes, or were they used more widely? And I found that it seems like they're used more widely than in these very specific types of spaces or contexts.
That's really interesting. Just immediately made me think of all of those ones that are decorated with like the kind of stuff that to me feels so directly linked to Symposia. Like, I don't want to just jump straight to like the people playing like Kotobos, but like, mm-hmm. I love that too. But yeah. Then all the like erotic decorated stuff where you'd like finish drinking your wine out of this kylix and then there's like just a big dick at the bottom. Like, mm-hmm. was that more linked to Symposia, or was like that kind of stuff even more broad? Like, was that in just sort of regular people's houses?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question that I didn't really address. So I mostly I found in general, like when I was looking at the pots, I can't remember off the top of my head now, because it's so long ago that I wrote that chapter, what specific kinds of parameters I used for the because of course there are lots and lots of different kinds of scenes, as you've already mentioned, some that
you
I didn't
just
even
lay it
at.
Out by dicks.
Yeah.
Like, weird that in your dissertation you didn't say like how many normal people had dicks on the bottom of their glasses.
But yeah, so I think actually the thing that I focused on were depictions of Symposia on, or what we think are Symposia on, vases. So of course, yes, there are lots and lots of different kinds of decoration, you know, of various scenes, various images that I think would be an interesting project, you know, in the realm of the of drinking, Greek drinking, to think about like the distribution of those images too, in the same way that I was thinking about distribution of shape, because, right, I was looking at the distribution of a very specific type of scene, so scenes of people drinking together, but yeah, that would be really interesting to kind of, you know, add on to that with thinking about these different kinds of scenes and thinking, you know, are certain types of scenes particularly in demand in these different contexts, because yeah if we tend to associate those like traditionally those various scenes or some scenes with all male drinking parties, right? It would be so cool to see, like, this vase that has a dick on the inside of the cup, right? That could be like found somewhere else in like a house that, like, or you know, anywhere that you're like, oh wow, like what were they doing in this house?
Yeah, I just like the idea of it being like a really normal family home of just like, you know, like a husband and wife, maybe a couple of kids, and like all of their, you know, all of their pottery is like weirdly erotic because I don't know, maybe they ended up with it or something. I don't know. I just like, I, because obviously I'm not coming at any of this from a scholarship perspective, I just like encounter all of it in so many different ways. And so I'm just always in awe of the stuff that they put on pottery so specifically, because like, some of it's the most beautiful, like mythological scenes, you know, storytelling. And then some of it's like the most bizarre sex scene ever. And you're just like, well, that's just on a glass. Like, why not? You know, I'm using the word glass loosely, but so like you were looking at shapes then too. So, I mean, like I know like a handful of shapes from, again, my like minimal research, but is there like certain types that were like maybe a bit more like normal, you know, for everyday people versus like a from a fancier party kind of perspective?
I think broadly I was trying to look at patterns of consumption of different traditionally sympotic shapes in Athens versus cause as you mentioned before, right, Athens is kind of like the center of all of this evidence we have for the symposium, and I wanted to compare that to somewhere that's not Athens, so I worked on a lot of material from the site of Olynthos in northern Greece. And broadly speaking, I think the types of shapes that they were consuming was very different, like was in general quite different from what we tend to see in Athens, which initially I thought maybe it was because like they just were not drinking in the same way as, I mean, and they probably weren't. But the main thing that I noticed was that like kylikes, these stemmed cups, are not very common in northern Greece in general. And that may be because, you know, they're not using them as frequently as we, you know, assume they are used in Greek symposia. Or it could be a chronological issue where most of the evidence that we have of people drinking from kylikes in Athens is from the 5th century, whereas in the 4th century, it goes out of kind of fashion. It goes out of fashion. There's not as many of them being produced even in Athens. So it's possible that because Olynthos is a little bit of a later site, they're not using those kinds of cups anymore. They're not producing them. They're not importing them either, because no one is making them. So that's kind of the broad pattern that I noticed. In terms of what kinds of shapes are found kind of in spaces that are more characteristically sympotic versus not, I think the distribution was pretty even, like in terms of the different shapes that I was looking at. I looked at, I think numbers evade me, but at least 5 or 6 different types of shapes, including craters. So the big mixing bowls for wine. And that was really interesting in that, like, I looked at decorated craters. I looked at just plain black gloss ones, and there were a few undecorated ones, and tried to see if I could match those up with different kinds of space. And that also was not as clear as one might expect, right? If you are looking for a sympotic space, you might expect to find a crater, but sometimes there isn't one, even though like the architecture might suggest that this space was used that way. So that raises questions of like, in the case where you don't have a crater in a clearly architecturally distinct sympotic space, what are they they must be mixing their wine with water somehow, so what are they using? Maybe a metal vessel, that tends to be the traditional interpretation, but you know, we don't have evidence of them, so like how can we know for sure? And then the opposite, you know, thinking about, you know, if everyone is drinking wine, as we all tend to expect, if there's no crater in like a normal house, but they have drinking vessels, you know, what are they mixing their wine with? Or even, you know, you could go even further. And as I did start thinking about this, like, are they mixing their wine at all? Right.
Yeah.
Like, there's no reason why they have to.
Are they super drunk?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So maybe they would be the ones that have the more erotic paintings in their house. You know, who knows?
The fun ones. Mm-hmm. That reminds me of like that quote. From like that, it's a fragment of like Eubulos, I think, right? Do you know the one I'm talking about, where he talks about like, it's a quote from Dionysus talking about like the levels of getting drunk during a party,
yeah,
like how much wine you're mixing. I just those kinds of things fill me with such joy of,
yeah,
like just the way they talked about just drinking culture, I guess, is like this deeply normal thing, like I don't know, it's so fun kind of in comparison to like a North American kind of mentality where like, obviously drinking is like really common, but it mm-hmm. still has this, there's like a very different mentality over like, of course we drink because it's like how we hydrate ourselves, except it's just usually wine and like yeah. maybe there's water in there. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's so fun. I just am always fascinated by the volume of these shapes. And I think, you know, somebody like me who's just coming across this stuff, like random stuff I'm reading or like, you know, museums and things, mm-hmm. like you tend to think of like the fancier stuff, right? And so the piece that's just coming to my mind, so I would just be curious to know if they're like common or totally rare, because they seem like they have to be rare, is like those super, like the animal-shaped rhytons. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the correct plural of rhyton is, but like you're holding like a goat head that's actually a drinking glass, but like you can't really set it down because it needs like a base that yeah. it doesn't have. Like, do we think those were common, do you know, or are they just so impractical they had to have been for like very special occasions?
That yeah, I did I wrote a term paper many years ago on Raita. I think the plural is Raita with an A. Specifically, yeah, the attic ones that are shaped like animals. And there's a person, I don't want to get their name wrong, but I think it's Miller. She wrote a book on like Athens and Persia, and like the influence of like Persian culture on Athens, and specifically looked at like various aspects of Athenian culture. But I remember there being a chapter or at least a section about Attic Raita and how that like transformation was achieved. So these animal headed cups come from like Persian culture, and you know, generally the same region, and they're made originally in like precious metals like silver, but they are like adopted into the Athenian repertoire of vessels, and that's kind of how they come to be. But they're different, right? Like they are traditionally not meant to be set down, and we have also examples from earlier periods in the Bronze Age as well, but the ones in Athens, most of them are, they do have a handle, right, to make it easier to pick them up, and they do often have a base on them because, again, right, they need to be drank or used in these very specific contexts that, you know, require like reclining and on whatever kind of furniture, maybe a couch, maybe a mattress on the ground, you know, what have you. And there are also often tables, right? So you need to set your cup down as you would with any other kind of cup. But I do not know how common they are. I don't think they are very common. Although every time I go to a museum, I always find another one, which is wild. And they're all different shapes, which is like, are there any repeat shapes? That would be yeah. something interesting to know. But from my perspective of like looking at so many different shapes that are like really common, and even some that like don't seem to be very common, like a bull sol. Like most people do not know what a bull sol is. They've probably never heard of it. Yep. But they are very common in the 4th century, so it's like they just kind of appear, but Raita I don't think are very common, and it would be interesting to look into that shape and figure out, first of all, why did they want to make this shape in the first place? The range of animals or other kinds of images, because I mean there are also some that are like in the shape of human heads too, like there's one that I can remember that's like Dionysus's face and a satyr's face and things like that, that are also vessels, and then so the range of shapes, and then also, yeah, just like, yeah, how many are there just out there, like, and the context that they've been found in, because that would probably help us get a sense of, you know, if they're found in graves, then maybe they weren't used very frequently. Mm-hmm. But if they're found in settlements, that might suggest that they were actually used in these various drinking parties, what kinds of drinking parties we wouldn't really necessarily be able to tell, but yeah, that would definitely be something interesting to look into. I don't know if anyone's done that research. I'm sure there's someone out there that has noticed and maybe done something with it. But if not, I mean, that would be a really, really interesting project.
Yeah. I mean, they're just so pretty, too. And like, I'm glad you mentioned the Bronze Age ones, too, because that's what I was going to bring up when you said that, you know, that the Attic ones kind of come from Persia, because that's really interesting that they come from Persia. Because, yeah, the, like, I mean, I think of a lot of the ones that I've seen, you know, in the National Archaeological Museum in Athens. But I also think of the ones that are on Crete, like in the Heraklion Museum, because those are really interesting, like, because they have like the bull's head right on, that's really popular to the point where I did get it tattooed on me, which is why I think of it. But like, it's like just a full blown statue of bull's head. And then you have to like actually know that it's a rhyton, because no part of it, just looking at it, can you even like see where you drink from, which I love.
Yeah.
Because it's like whatever the angles are that it's positioned, like you can't tell that that is a good drinking vessel. It's just a bull's head statue. And then you're like, wait, we drink from that? What?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, yeah, it's a, I think the topic is definitely more complicated than just, yeah. Like, I mean, I did just say that like the idea probably, like the inspiration probably came from Persia or, you know, somewhere in that region. But that's in the 5th century, right? Like that's just like one proposition. Whereas definitely we have animal headed cups called rhyta already in the Bronze Age in Greece. They do look very different. There are more similarities, I think, between like the Attic ones of the 5th century and like Persian vessels versus, yeah, between Athens and the Bronze Age. So the idea definitely was there. But like, I mean, like I said, someone who knows more probably has made this connection already and like can explain it better than I can. But yeah, I think... Yeah, but yeah, that's a really good point. And I actually had students this semester have to write about, like in like detail and like analyze the bull's head rhyton from Crete, from Knossos. And like so many of them were like talking about like where the openings were in it. And I was like, I had no idea because I have never looked at it that closely. But like, I think one of the openings like in the chin, which is wild to me because like you can't see it in any of the photos that you ever look at. But yeah, there's one in the chin. And I think there's one like on like in the head at the top of the head somewhere.
Yeah, that's what I would have assumed, too. Yeah, because you can't see it from like the angle that it's displayed or the photos. Yeah. No. And like, to be clear, I'm not trying to like put you on the spot with the Persia thing. I think it's really interesting because like, because you're right. Like, and you know what the listeners might not know, but like the ones on Crete that look like a bull head, because there's a couple of them I know, like I think one of those in the National Archaeological Museum, but they do look really different. Like they don't look like drinking vessels, whereas the Attic ones, like it might be like a donkey's head in a really fun way, but it is very clearly like it has a handle. You know where to hold it. It, again, would still be very impractical to put down, I think, but like, and very top heavy. But you can tell, obviously, that it's a drinking vessel. So yeah, it's like they are quite different. And then when you mentioned the heads thing, too, like that reminded me there's a lot of those ones, or I don't know if there's a lot, but I know I've seen like there's very famous pictures of the ones where it's like they've depicted people from Africa, too. And they've got like really interesting kind of, I don't know, just like at their like kind of exploration on like people to, that they've encountered with. And then, you know, it's kind of stuff that I feel like when you look at it now, sometimes something about it screams racist.
Yeah.
But I'm like, I know that it probably wasn't, because it's the context to us that makes it seem like it should be. I don't even know, but I'm sure you know the ones I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I think honestly, like I've heard many talks about this, and I know like there are people out there that have done more research into this, and that have like done like really good research into this. Like I think Naji Olia at William and Mary, he has, I think his dissertation was on a lot of this kind of topic. And so he probably looked very closely into this. I'm very bad at reading people's dissertations because I don't even want to read mine. But
I've never read one. So there's literally no judgment here, to be very clear.
But like he is definitely a person that I think like that comes to mind when I think of like vase painting and depictions of Africans in art in antiquity. But like I said, there are several people that I can think of that have done that kind of research. And I mean, it is really interesting to like think about, because yes, there are some specific things that come to mind for us, like, yeah, it's like, oh, that's shocking and like kind of racist. But also, like, if we think about it, like in the context of like what was happening in antiquity and like what their experiences were, like it may be a little bit different from what we immediately, you know, think of. But mm-hmm. But yeah, there's some interesting nuance there for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels to me that, like, and I don't, you know, I'm not gonna make that this whole topic, obviously, but like, it feels to me that the things that would make us, like, specifically as North Americans, but I think generally as like the Western countries that were like involved in slavery, like that there are the things that make it that those look racist are like the things that have been created in the last like 500 to 600 years that then, you know, are racist now, but like obviously weren't back then. So it's just really interesting to kind of, I don't think about that stuff broadly.
Yeah.
But yeah, just the idea that they were like making drinking vessels out of like heads, be they human or animal. they were just weirdly creative with pottery in a way that is so interesting. And like the head ones too, I think they're like often double-sided. There's like a face on each side. Anyway, sorry, now I'm just like constantly just like imagining all the different things.
I think my favorite Raiton that I've ever seen, and I can't remember where I saw it, but there was one that I saw that was in the shape of a lobster claw. And that was that was very cool to me.
I mean, they just made some really weird pottery back then, and I love them for it.
At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Hey girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
My favorite thing is going through like the really tiny regional museums or just the ones that are like attached to different sites. Like the one that's coming to my mind is like at Karamichos. Mm-hmm. And like, obviously, you know, those are tied to funeral, you know, procedures. That's the wrong word. You know what I mean? it's a cemetery. But like some of the stuff that are found there are really interesting. And they just make such weird stuff, and it like doesn't make it into the big museums. And you just get to see this like bizarre little thing made of pottery, you know, whether they're drinking out of it or not. I'm just typically just in awe of the weird stuff the Greeks did, which is why I was excited, particularly for this conversation. But So drinking generally, like, did you look mostly at the drinking vessels themselves, or like, do you know, much about what they drank, if anything, beyond wine? Like, that's something I've always been interested in. I feel like, I mean, what little Googling I've done has like minimal answers. Like, I know in the East that they had things that weren't wine, and I imagine it made into Greece. But it feels to me that like wine was still like very much like the dominant thing to drink.
Yeah. I think the chapter that I wrote that was about like, answering the question of like, okay, if they didn't have a crater, like what were they drinking? Were they drinking wine? Were they drinking something else? I think the only thing I looked into was beer. Mm-hmm. And from like the few articles and books that I could find, it seemed pretty conclusively decided that Greeks didn't drink beer.
Okay.
But I am not super convinced. And I don't think a lot, I can't remember exactly, but I get the feeling just from like trying to think back to when I wrote that chapter and did that research. I don't think there was a lot of archaeological evidence. And I think it's very difficult to like be super certain about the kinds of things that they're drinking, because the process of doing like the analysis of the cups has to be done right when you take it out of the ground. Like you have to analyze like the soil inside of the vessel and the soil around and get like the analysis kind of immediately. So it's not really super possible, from what I understand, to do that kind of analysis later, after it's already been cleaned and, you know, conserved and all of that. So from what I understand, it beer, even though like neighboring regions definitely were drinking beer, it doesn't seem like it infiltrated very much into Greece or at all, which I found really interesting, because if we're thinking about Greek cities, and I tried to be very careful about how I was wording this, like, you know, I'm not talking about Greek people necessarily. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the people who live in Greek cities, which is different because not everyone living in Greece is technically Greek or adhering to what we believe generally Greeks did and drank and, you know, and believed. So I'm not super convinced that no one was drinking beer or anything else, really, right? Like, it's possible that like there were some people who like had immigrated or from these neighboring regions that drink beer, and that's all they knew, and they came to Greece and they lived in Greece and they were maybe drinking beer, right, in their house because they wanted to do that rather than drinking wine, which I am convinced that most, if not everyone, that was Greek was probably drinking wine of some kind. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that everyone was mixing their wine with water. I mean, I think many of them probably were, but I also think there is, like, you have to think about, like, social divisions too, right? Like, elites mm-hmm. probably drank differently or drank different things than lower class people, right? They had access, they had different access to different things, right? There's lots of research about different kinds of wine that were moving around the Mediterranean in the 5th and 4th centuries. But it's, you know, there's different qualities of wine even today, right? And not mm-hmm. everyone, like, I can't buy, like, a $300 bottle of wine, right? I'm going to buy, like, the $20 bottle of wine. So it's, like, I think it's the same kind of thing in antiquity and in, like, 5th and 4th century Greece specifically. Like, I think, thinking about, even though I don't have, you know, a specific answer, I think it's certainly possible that people were drinking other things than wine and also drinking their wine differently. But I don't know that there's been a lot of specific evidence for that. Mm-hmm. One of the questions that came up when I was writing the chapter where I talk about possibilities of other things that people are drinking was milk. Very specifically, someone asked me if they were drinking milk. And I was like, I have no idea. So, like, I mean, honestly, there could be a lot of other options out there that I had not considered, but maybe someone out there has considered.
Yeah, I would have never thought about milk. I am not a milk drinker. Like, yeah, the idea that it, like, anyone just sits down and drinks a glass of milk to me is bizarre.
Yeah, me too.
Like, right. Oh, people do that. I grew up with a lactose intolerant mother and it shows.
Yeah.
No, that's so interesting. But, like, yeah, I mean, I'm with you. Like, what are the chances that no one drank beer? Like, it was a multicultural area. And if, like, I don't know enough about elsewhere, but Egypt had a lot of beer, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they were heavy on beer.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the likelihood that, like, no one in Greece is drinking beer, that seems like the biggest stretch to say with any kind of confidence.
Yeah, and it's also, yeah, like, you have to think, again, as always, like, where are they getting their evidence from, right? Yeah. If they are using archaeological evidence, like, is it safe to say they probably were looking at Athens? Because I think, in terms of, like, proximity to places that drink beer, I think, like, Thrace maybe was also a place that drank beer. Mm-hmm. Like, northern Greece is right there. Like, they're knocking on their door. It's very likely that some people from Thrace were living in Greece and drinking beer. But if they're not looking there for that evidence, then, of course, there's going to be no evidence that anyone was drinking beer. So, again, problem with Athens being the center of everything. I love Athens. I go there as often as I can, but it is, yeah, definitely a scholarly issue when it comes to thinking about Greek drinking.
I mean, when it comes to thinking about, like, most things, especially mm-hmm. when you're outside of academia too, because, like, every time you look for anything, like, it predominantly is just about Athens, but everyone's like, Greece, and you're like, that's Athens. Okay, yeah. Cool. Like, it's like, I mean, I'm so guilty of it, you know, in the early days of the podcast before I knew better and where to look and everything, like, you know, all my knowledge on, like, the treatment of women and stuff is based in Athens. And, oh, Athens was pretty shitty to women. Like, you know, it makes it seem like everyone was, but pretty Athenian. Like, yeah, it's so interesting. And I love Athens too. It's the fucking best. Mm-hmm. But also, I would like to know more about elsewhere. But I have a friend who studies Thrace. So now I'm like, okay, cool. I'm going to, like, mark that down. It's, like, a thing to ask her when she comes on the show. Because, like, I mean, yeah, it seems to me that, you know, that Thrace or that, you know, like, Lesbos or Lemnos or Chios, like, any of those eastern islands or like the parts of modern Turkey that were full on, you know, Greek at the time. Mm-hmm. Like, what is the likelihood that everyone's like, oh, you passed into a Hellenic city state. Like, nobody drinks anything but wine here. Like, it also, like, you know, I'm not an archaeologist, you know, but I took 2 classes over 10 years ago. So, but, like, it seems to me that also saying with any kind of, like, certainty, like, definitively saying anything didn't happen. Mm-hmm. Is pretty, like, of a bit much of a stretch. Like, how can you prove something didn't happen, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, an argument from absence is not a valid argument in most cases.
And like, just feels like logical. Like they're going to drink other things. One thing I feel like comes across, you know, as like a kind of common, it seems like it's probably a common misconception, I should say, like, is that wine was one of like the only things they drank. Like, did they, do we know if they were just like regularly drinking water? Like, I feel like I heard somewhere 20 years ago that like the water made them sick, so they mixed it with wine. But I realize I have like no idea where that would have come from, or if it has any validity, or if I just like heard a thing once when I was a child and it stuck.
Yeah, I feel like I heard the same thing. So it's probably written somewhere. Yeah, it's probably written somewhere and someone said that and like we all just have collectively remembered it. I think that sounds like the same thing that I heard. I have not heard anything different, but I mean, they're using it like if it's making them sick, I don't understand why they would be putting it in their wine.
Yeah.
how does that work? I'm not a chemist. I don't know how any of that works, but it's interesting, but it seems in general that people were not drinking water anywhere ever. So but I don't know anyone that studies like water in antiquity. So I don't know how that would have worked, but like, I mean, they're using water for like all kinds of things, right? Like, you know, they're in the Roman world, they're piping it in like, over like thousands of meters, I guess. But, you know, like, I mean, I guess I don't have an answer. Like, I guess that's like where I'm going is like, I don't know if anyone was drinking water.
No, and I like, yeah, love when people don't have an answer too, because it's just more like, I just like to theorize on this shit. And I'm like, I'm just going to theorize on it to you. But I'm also really glad that you had also like, heard this, because as soon as I was saying it, I was like, where the fuck did I hear that from? Like, is that based in literally anything? I have no idea. But I don't sound completely crazy, so I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So like, what kind of other stuff, you know, whether you have like in-depth details or not still, but like what other stuff did you study when it comes to just like this idea of like drinking culture? Like, do we know if they had other specific types of drinking parties that we, you know details of that like weren't symposia or what? Like,
I don't know specifically if anything has been like explicitly said anywhere, because I mean, even the symposium, right, is like very tenuous. We have some written sources that talk about, I mean, like Plato's Symposium is the obvious one. You know, it's called the Symposium, so we should assume that is a symposium. But like other kinds of drinking are not really specific, or at least from what I understand, are not like explicitly spelled out. Because I think too, right, we're looking at all of these sources with our symposium goggles on. So everything we see is a symposium unless otherwise, you know, explicitly stated. So like, yeah, I think, I mean, obviously I believe that people were having other kinds of drinking parties all the time, but they are much harder to find archaeologically and much harder to characterize archaeologically because, I mean, you know, the symposium is so popular a subject because, you know, all of the evidence is like kind of is obvious, right? Like we have, or it appears to be obvious, like we have archaeologically distinct spaces. We have like mosaics and decorated rooms and, you know, evidence that they were reclining on couches. And we have these descriptions and texts and it all, and images on vases, right? Like they, it all seems to point to this very specific type of drinking party. But like looking at like the distribution of pottery in relation to these spaces and thinking about, you know, trying to think more broadly about like what kinds of other people lived in Greek cities and all the other types of people that could be drinking, right? You know, at any given time, I think really helped to at least sort of try to come up with a picture of other types of drinking parties, less formal ones. You know, I don't know that I ever like explicitly gave anything a name, but you know, just like thinking of it as kind of a spectrum in the same way that we think, you know, if you think of drinking in any context today, right? Like you can have a formal dinner party and have drinks there. You can go out to a bar. You can have an informal any other kind of party, right? And you can drink in various contexts. I mean, like I'm having a drink right now, talking to you, right? Like any kind of context. There's only two people here and we're not even in the same space. So
me
like,
too, thinking,
to be yes. So like thinking about, I think it's more in a way conceptual at this point. Obviously, like I did try to find archaeological evidence that supports these ideas. And I did, I mean, I did come up with kind of a model for identifying other kinds of drinking, like beyond the symposium, by looking at the pottery, by looking at the architecture. But giving it all like names is very difficult. And I think too, like the term symposium is very problematic itself, because it comes with its own baggage, right? Like we assume that it is just one thing and that it is tied to all of these other activities and objects and spaces, when in fact it probably wasn't that rigid. And especially not, you know, if we're thinking about it in the context of Athens, it's probably not the same anywhere else in the Greek world, if they were calling it a symposium too. So essentially, I have not gotten to, I never found any specific evidence that like explicitly said like this is some other kind of drinking. I tend to think about like drinking, like when I talk about drinking in my dissertation and in general, when I talk about drinking, I like to just call it group drinking in general, and then like think about it as like more or less formal. And then, like, I'm sure over time I will, as I do more research and think more about it, like, maybe I'll be able to assign more specific kind of parameters and labels to them. But I hesitate to put labels on things, because that's how we got into this mess in the first place, by calling it a symposium. But yeah, something that I found really interesting, but I could not at all find any specific evidence for, is women drinking. Because as we said before, right, we can assume that everyone was drinking, so why not women too? But as it turns out, it is very, very difficult to find specific archaeological evidence for women drinking. Who would have thought?
That's so wild. But also, just to like, I want to talk about this women idea. I mean, even though there's nothing. But of course, you know what you're saying too, but not being able to put a label on things, like, that makes so much sense. You know, like, we wouldn't know. It would be so hard to tell what they're doing, like, in any kind of, yeah, like, rigid kind of set thing. And then I imagine, yeah, it'd be really easy to fall into like the symposium of it all, which is that you just like make these assumptions. And now I can't stop thinking about like Plato's symposium being like an assumption about symposia broadly, because it's the most absurd. And like, I like the idea of like, that's what every single one was like. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about gender and sexuality in the most bizarre and fascinating of ways. And that's just pure, that's entirely what symposia are for. But like, yeah, I mean, the idea that we have like no evidence for women drinking is fucking hilarious. Like, it just feels like such a great like encapsulation of so much when it comes to studying this stuff. Like, they mm-hmm. just didn't. They were just all really dehydrated, like, and even more so than the fact that like people are only drinking wine. Like, imagine how dehydrated you would be. I just can't fathom it. Women, the nerve.
I will say there isn't no evidence for women drinking. There are images on vases of women drinking. But of course, they have all been interpreted as prostitutes.
I was going to say heteri. Oh, so great. Like,
okay, but like, why can't it be just a normal woman drinking wine? Like, I don't understand. So I don't know that anyone has revisited this. I think like Rebecca Fudo Kennedy wrote an article a while ago about heteri specifically, and that's kind of, I think that was really the jumping off point for me, like thinking more broadly about who's living in these cities. Cause right, like if you're from somewhere else and you bring your woman to Greece and you live in Greece and like you're used to drinking with your wife or your sister or whoever in this other place, why not continue to do that? Like, who is policing you in your house? Right. So I think like, I would really love to try and find some way to prove that this was happening, because it's so frustrating to like find out someone is talking about this vase. I'm like, well, this is such a weird vase. Like, why are these women drinking? Like, no one, like, we don't have any texts that say this. And then it's suddenly, like, all about prostitutes and not at all giving women credit for, like, just having a nice time with their gal pals, right?
The leap to call every single woman in any single thing a hetera is, like, my just, like, constant battle within everything I read. Like, I know that, you know, even Symposia, like, they're all male, but then often there were heterae there. Mm-hmm. And you're like, cool, like, we get to call it all male, like, except for the women who were there, I guess, for sex or just, like, companionship. You know, they weren't always there for sex, I guess. Mm-hmm. But, like, yeah, it's just this idea that, like, the assumption seems to be, you know, and then, of course, I know this is changing, but it is still so locked into this, you know, subject, is that, like, every single woman in a public space had to have been a sex worker in some way, mm-hmm. like, be she heterae or porni or, like, whatever level, but, like, there's no possible way that any woman in a space, like, was not somehow trading sex for something else. Mm-hmm. And it's just wild. And yeah. Of course, like, I also like to complain every time I have to talk about hetera, like, just the fact that the word means companion, and when it is referred to as a man, we tend to say things like I know a lot of the because Patroclus is called that so often, and he's always like comrade or like friend or like it's something, and then as soon as it's a woman, it's like, no, she traded sex for stuff, like,
yeah. Yes.
But yeah, I mean, that's I wish that was surprising. Like, okay, no. If a woman is drinking somewhere, she's a hetera. I mean, I assume that this would be so hard, but I imagine that because you're, you know, you're looking at, like, the ancient Greek home, and especially when you're, you know, looking at Olynthos is the site you were saying, right?
Yeah.
Like, I just am so curious about normal people, like, just regular everyday people. And I, you know, I understand that that's, like, often one of the hardest things, I think, to understand, because the whole point about, like, being regular or, like, in other words, poor, is that, like, you probably don't leave a lot for people to find, or it gets destroyed before anyone can find it. But that's just so interesting to me, is, like, what regular people were doing. Like, I mean, you've talked a little bit about that and everything, but did you learn anything really interesting about kind of, like, what regular normal people did? Like, I mean, even beyond drinking, just like in your work on, like, I know when we met you were going to work in Greece on, like, just a house or something, which just seems so fascinating. So I was just like, I would love to know, like, anything about regular people, if you know fascinating things. Everything's fascinating, to be clear.
Yeah. I think, I mean, I have not, I don't understand it at all, or, like, I haven't really seen any of the results of it, because I think it's still happening. But something that I would be really interested in finding out more about is, like, what people were eating. Because that's something that we, like, I mean, in general, the project that I worked on and still work on at Olynthos did a lot of, like, sampling of the soil to, like, be able to do these scientific analyses that tell us, like, what kinds of, like, food and starches and things that they were eating. I think it was called starch analysis. But, like, we were not allowed to eat around the trenches at all, because it would mess up the analysis, which was a little frustrating at first, but, like, I get it now. But that would be really interesting, because, I mean, I think the main thing that people tend to think about, like, when you're thinking about food, is, like, bones and, like, seeds and things that survive, but like, that's a really, like, in-depth kind of analysis of, like, the different kinds of, like, in general, like, what kinds of food people were eating. So I would be really interested to find that out. And then there's also, like, an analysis of, like, the, like, kind of crushed up stuff that, like, is left behind, also, like, in, like, the floor. So, like, whenever we reach a floor level in, like, any of the rooms or any of the trenches we're in, we always would have to, like, take a, like, sample the entire floor, all of the dirt that was there that was found. And then there's one person that usually worked with, like, assistants that would go through all of the material that came out of that. So, like, little teeny bits of things from everything from, like, little organic matter to little pieces of pottery to little, like, I think once they found, like, a little miniature, like, hydria, like a little baby water jar. That was like it was amazing. But like the little crushed up stuff that like gets like ground up into the floor is also really interesting, because it's like all of that stuff in general would be missed, right? Because if you're just digging, right, you only see the big stuff. So I think that's really interesting to like just to get a sense of like, yeah, all of the stuff that, I mean, if you think about, I mean, we vacuum our houses or sweep our houses now, but like if you think about all of the stuff that you drop or all of the things that could accumulate on your floor over time, and then like suddenly like you abandon your house or your house collapses and then it all, and then somebody comes and digs it up, right? All of that stuff that's accumulated in the floor can tell us a lot about like what you were doing like at that time, or like, you know, what that space was used for. So, I mean, I don't do either of these kinds of analyses, but those things are really interesting for like thinking about, especially how space is used. Yeah. And the kinds of things people eat. I work on wine, but like, I'm not doing it from a scientific perspective. So like those kinds of analysis, are really interesting for thinking about everyday people, because you're thinking about like everyone in the house, not just like the elite men who probably were drinking on a day-to-day basis. So yeah, I think those are the kind of main things I would say. I don't know if those are super super cool or interesting, but they're interesting to me.
No, but I love that so much. Like, I think the thing, it's so interesting talking to experts like yourself, because I think that stuff like that, like obviously not, you know, like the way you're talking about it, you know, I can tell like it's not, you know, you just said it's not like what you study directly, but like I think that like people who are in archaeology or even just historians broadly, like you just think that's like a, oh yeah, you know, like that thing, like I think that's something that it just is like a thing that you encounter. But meanwhile, I'm just sitting here being like, oh my god, you of course, like you would want to know every single fucking thing that fell on the floor, like holy shit, think of the stuff we can learn from that. And so like I love these moments, because I think you underestimate how interesting fucking everything is, because like it's, you just live in that world, and I'm just sitting here like, fuck, that's so cool. But also like my favorite thing about this podcast is that like my listeners, who are by and large not academics and just but like want to hear this shit, so I'm so glad you brought that up. It's like, I think that's fascinating, and I couldn't help but think about my apartment, my ADHD brain, and like how much more I should vacuum, and how if that, you know, if someone was to come in and study whatever I left behind, it would be like fucking cat litter that my cat dragged around, and that like I didn't sweep up every single day, so there's a few pieces, or you know, the tiny bits of popcorn that I need to vacuum off my carpet from watching TV.
That. Yeah, I actually, I will admit that I thought of that specifically because I looked over to the left and I was like, wow, I need to vacuum my carpet. Yeah. I was like, oh yeah, that's a thing that we can find.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. And like literally my apartment, somebody would be like, well, she had a cat and she probably could have cleaned more. Like, number one thing.
I will say we never think that. I don't know if anyone thinks that, but we never say that out loud when we are excavating.
Well, thankfully, like you've got like 2,500 gears in between. I feel like there's like a little less judgment, thankfully. No, but that's so interesting. Like, completely selfishly, I'm also working on a novel that's like, I'm a nerd for history, so it's mythology, but I'm like, it's going to be like, you know, as like pseudo historical as possible, because I want to like just be nerdy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like I've thought about certain things. Like, I also, you know, I'm not going to go that in depth, but I'm already like, oh my god, oh, like the little things in like the floor or the kitchen. Like, I love the idea of normality. I just think normality is something that is so often not like ignored, but just like we don't think about it. Like regular people who are reading about ancient Greece or mythology, like you don't think about regular life. You think about the myths, those are absurd. Yeah. Or like, you know, it's wars, it's art, and that's like the art's amazing for sure. But you don't get a sense of like what regular people were just like existing and doing on the day to day, or like leaving shit on their floor, or I just think that's so cool.
Yeah. I think I am definitely, I was definitely dazzled by like the exceptional things from the very beginning. But yeah, I've definitely come to appreciate the little things now. And just like, yeah, thinking about all of these other people that lived, and you're like, okay, but like what were they doing? Because it's really hard to find that kind of evidence and like think about these people, because yeah, like they don't stand out as much, but yeah, I think we're really trying like to do that, to like, you know, a lot of projects now are really trying to focus on like the big picture and for everyday life. And like I'm really happy that I was able to become a part of this project. And then now I work at Pella, where we're kind of doing the same sorts of things. Like we're looking for a house in the Hellenistic period, and like thinking about the same sorts of things. So yeah, so it's really interesting also to me to be looking for evidence of these just regular people and like trying to bring out their perspectives a bit more, because yeah, we tend to focus on the things that are most obvious to us, like the symposium.
Yeah, I mean, it's my favorite part of just like having people like you on to talk.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours. Like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more. Made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and Vlastar on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Jean. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano!
Jean, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return. Your time won't. And we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You mentioned Rebecca Fudo Kennedy, and like she came on to talk about just like foreign people and women in Athens really specifically, and that was just so interesting because we do get like at least a little bit more of a sense of like a regular person because they were a foreigner, so they had this like exceptional status that mm-hmm. then we can like track, and that's so interesting. But yeah, I mean, I also just think that like especially, you know, in the environment in which we currently live, specifically as North Americans, but I think just generally the West in 2023, like I'm just an angry leftist. And the idea that like all we ever know is the elite is really annoying when I think about it, like in our modern context. Like if 2,500 years from now, people are judging all of North America based on what the fuck Jeff Bezos is doing, like I'm going to be pissed, you know? Yeah. So like, I then like translate that to the ancient world and be like, okay, I wonder what the normal people were doing. The people who didn't go to symposia because they were not loaded in Athens and a man. And like, so yeah, I just, even if we don't have the answers, like, I just love the idea that they were looking for them or that like somebody is looking for them. And, you know, it's oh my God, just like choking on myself. I just seriously love that I get to talk to people like you who like research this stuff, because this stuff like doesn't, it stays in the academy a lot of the time. Yeah. You know, like it's in papers, it's in like $200 books that no one knows that they want to pick up, because why would you have access to even knowing that exists?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, like this just leads me to, I swear I do it in like every conversation. It's just like, it's fucking cool that people want to come on my show and tell me this stuff. And that the people want to listen, and therefore it is validating to me to bother you enough to come onto the show. But yeah, it's just really nerdy and cool. Like, do you have like a favorite thing that you learned doing your dissertation, like in terms of the drinking culture? Like, is there something that you just still think about longingly? I don't know why I use the word longingly, but you know what I mean?
I feel like it's a very obvious thing, but I never really thought about it until I was writing my dissertation. But like the amount of like resources and labor that go into just building an Andron or like a formal dining room in a house, for all this time, right? Like I was reading about symposia, I knew all about all of these things, and I was digging at Olynthos, and I saw like examples of these formal dining rooms, but it never occurred to me that that is very much a clear symbol of one's status and one's wealth, to be able to have a space like that. And like they're not super uncommon, I would say. I want to say maybe definitely more than 10. I can't remember the exact number, but there are a lot of them at Olynthos, compared with like the number of houses that were excavated. Mm. So it's like, surely like that requires a lot of time and money to create something like that in your house, whether you have it put in, you know, from the beginning when it's constructed, or you add it in later, which happened in some places. So thinking about, or in some houses. So thinking about like the different, like, and I did think about this, the different levels of expenditure that went into like creating, you know, different sizes of these spaces. Some of them would be built with like different walls, like the wall, like the blocks used in the wall might be a little bit nicer than others. The decoration of the mosaics inside might are very different in different. So like there are ones that depict figures and like figural scenes, mythological scenes. There are ones that are just geometric. And then there are also ones that are just like plain like cement floors. So thinking about that in terms of like levels of expenditure and wealth and status, I thought was really interesting, because I had never thought about it in that much detail before. And I was like, oh, like that actually makes a lot of sense. Like why we might tie these spaces very specifically to symposia, because, you know, if we're thinking of symposia as these very exclusive drinking parties, that it makes sense, right, for these spaces to be associated with this very specific group, at least some of the time. Because I think, too, another thing that I learned kind of through my research is that there are some people that believe, and I believe it now, too, that, like, these spaces were not just used for these drinking parties all the time. Like, I mean, it's like today, right? Like, you might have a dining room in your house or any kind of room, but, like, it may be used for a drinking party or a party for, like, one night, but, like, the rest of the day, right, it could be used for many other things. So I think, like, one scholar noted that they found evidence of, like, weaving equipment in one of these spaces before. So it's possible that it was used by women, right? So it's very interesting. Like, this is why I'm always pro everything is multifunctional, including space and objects, because, right, like, you can't just say, like, this space was used only by men all of the time, because that's, like, like, it's just not efficient, right? Like, why would they have done that? And it's the same now, right? It's like, why would you have it for, like, I don't know anyone that has a formal dining room. Like, if you have one, you're probably using it for other things now. Like, no one is just, like, blocking off one room all of the time and they don't touch it ever, right? Like, I think that's a very, I mean, it's definitely a modern thing, because I remember having in my childhood home a space that we did not touch except on special occasions, but like but now, right, like no one does that. So I think that's like very important to remember, is that space as well as objects are very multifunctional. So again, right, that notion of a symposium kind of becomes more problematic in you know more ways than we've already noted.
I'm so glad I asked that. That's fucking fascinating. So, okay. I'm going to, like, try to weave through how many questions I have. Like, that one, it sounds like the beer thing. You know, this, like, assumption that, like, oh, they only use them for this one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to generalize because I'm allowed. I recognize that as an academic, you probably wouldn't. But it just sounds like an old white man thing to say when they are researching this shit. It's just like, this is the thing I found. I connect it with my personal life experience in some kind of way. And thus, like, that's the for sure answer, instead of just like one small part of what is probably a much larger answer. Like, it just feels like the hetera thing. It feels like the beer thing. It's just like all women are sex workers and all dining rooms are used for symposia and Greeks only drink wine. But like, okay. The dining room. That's so interesting. Were mosaic floors really common in Greece? Like, I think a lot of the evidence that we tend to have is from later, like Hellenistic and on, and then into the Roman period.
Mm-hmm.
My obsession tends to be with classical and archaic. So maybe it's just like it's later. Like, were mosaic floors like really popular in like, not obviously not like a poor person's house, but like in like a semi-wealthy person's house?
So, like I said, I can't remember the exact number of them. I think it's definitely, like, there, of course, are in these traditionally sympotic spaces in Androns, for sure, very often. We also find them in some courtyards. So courtyards could have mosaics in them in the 5th, 4th century, and Olynthos. There are a couple examples of that. Some houses had more than one mosaic in them. So, like, you might have one in your Andron, and you might have one in the courtyard, both in the same house. Or you could have multiple dining rooms in your house. So that means multiple mosaics. I definitely think they are more common, as you say, in later periods, as they become kind of the spaces become more elaborately decorated in general, and the house becomes more like there's more attention to that kind of detail. I think it's more limited in the 5th and 4th centuries, and that's probably why we don't see them as much earlier. But I do think they become mosaics become more popular and more elaborate, because in the 5th and 4th centuries, they're just kind of like, you know, pebble mosaics, very, very simplistic kinds of designs. There, like I said, there are some figural designs, but they're not like super common. They, because I'm sure they probably take a lot more time and effort to create. But yeah, I think Atalanthos, they are common, but not like the most common, right? Like most houses do not have any kind of decoration at all. But I think it becomes more common, as you say, in like the Hellenistic and Roman periods.
That's so, I fucking love that. Sorry, I'm like obsessively taking notes. But yeah, so that's so interesting. And then it made me just think of like other really like normal spaces in ancient Greek homes. Like, do we know much about like their kitchen functions? I'm trying not to ask you questions that I immediately have them and like be like, oh my God, I'm going to put this in my novel because I promise it's also interesting to everybody. But like, I'm so fascinated by that. And I imagine it would like fall under that kind of purview of drinking. Mm-hmm. But now I'm just generally obsessed with like ancient Greek houses. Sorry, you opened up a Pandora's jar.
As you should be. I'm always trying to convert people.
Well, great. I'm here. But yeah, like just this idea of this formal dining room is really interesting to me. But like when it comes to kitchens, like were they very much, you know, obviously we're going to be talking about like when it comes to places with androns generally is like a level of wealth, I imagine, in order to have something like that. So I imagine that would also correspond to like, you know, servants and things. But like when it comes to kitchens, were they like, do we know if they were a space that was primarily reserved entirely for servants? Like, was it a normal household kind of thing amongst regular people? Like, I realize I don't know enough about just like daily kind of life stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get the feeling. So I didn't look, obviously I focused on this very specific circumstance. And I like now that I'm thinking about it, like I do wish I had looked more into like family things. Cause I think in my own education through grad school, like there's not really as much from what I understand and what I learned, like there's not as much about like Greek families as there are about Roman families. Like, oh, I think like,
so many things.
Yeah, I took a whole class on like Roman women from birth to death. So like, you know, like I learned about the whole gamut of Roman family. But I don't think I have ever studied in as much detail Greek families, and I wonder if that's because there's not as much like detailed information about like Greek families as a whole and like how that operated. Like the way that I understand it, right, is that like there was definitely like, you know, the household itself, the family itself, and then there were other people that were in the household, like servants and enslaved peoples, right, that, you know, also were in the house. I don't think the space was as like delimited in the same way as later Roman houses were, from what I have seen and the research that I've done of the houses that I've looked at, from Olynthos, like it and other places of the same, relatively the same period. Mostly like the house as a whole is pretty much the same. Like, I mean, yes, there's like usually the one or two spaces that are like more elaborately decorated tend to be associated with formal drinking. But I mean, I don't think like most of the rest of the house, right, is exactly the same. So like trying to separate out, like I keep saying, right, like the whole house is basically multifunctional. I would assume that everyone was always everywhere, right? Like, I don't think that like anyone was ever separated from anyone else. I think the division was more public, like outside versus inside versus like rather than like the people inside being separated from each other because it's so central or centrally organized, right? Like Greek houses of the 5th century and the 4th century were organized around a courtyard. So like you had to go like through the courtyard in order to access any of the other spaces. So it was very much like, I think the division was very much like everybody outside of the household was controlled. And then like the people inside of the house, like generally mingled. And I mean, maybe they used, like the same spaces at different times, of the day. Like I said, like with the formal dining room, the Andron, it's possible that it was used at least some of the time by other people besides men drinking, right? Like it could have been a good space for weaving. It could have been a space for grinding grain for food, you know, depending on the season and the time of day. So I think it's my understanding, but I could be missing something because I didn't get into like the household in general, in terms of the people, so much in my dissertation, which I'm now realizing I probably should have thought more about, but I will make a note and I will definitely come back to it for the book. But it would be interesting to know like how much information there is, because like I said, like it seems like there's, I mean, as with most things, there's way more in the Roman world, but like for the Greeks it's not as clear. But yeah, like I said, at least from the organization of the house, the decoration of the house in this period, it seems not necessarily egalitarian because everybody's of different statuses, but like there is definitely some sharing of space, and like it's not as like clear of a division. And I mean, thinking specifically about kitchens, since you mentioned that at the beginning, like, I mean, all of the kitchens I've seen seem to be about the same, you know, no matter what kind of house, no matter how big it is, no matter if there's an Andron or not, they seem to be kind of on the same level, identified usually by like a hearth, or I mean, cooking pots are very distinctive. They tend to have like burning on the outside, right? Because they're being used over a fire. So I think, yeah, in general, based on the architecture, based on the stuff found in these houses, that would be kind of my interpretation of Greek families in general.
I love that. It's just really interesting. Yeah, I love this normality idea. Like, just these things I haven't thought about in that realm of, I mean, I know about the hearth. I'm not ridiculous. But yeah, I just love this idea of like just regular people doing regular things and multifunctionality, because it just seems so reasonable. And yet, yeah, I think there is this assumption that like, they're like, of course, you know, people that long ago had to live like these completely different lives than us. And it's like reasonably like humans, human, you know, like things change. Yes. But ultimately, like, yeah, humans, human.
Yeah.
And there are some things that are just sort of like deeply normal human things. And the main one would be like using spaces in a way that is practical and like reasonable and like gets the best use out of like your space, but also your time and everything to do with that. Yeah, it's just really generally really interesting, and I'm kind of obsessed with all of this, so thank you.
Yeah.
If you would like, I would also love if you wanted to talk about, I'm not going to try to pronounce the Greek word that is in your website name, but if you wanted to talk about that at all and share with my listeners, because I know a lot of my listeners are in school, in university for classics now. A lot of them tell me that they did it because they started listening, and then I want to cry. So yeah, I mean, if you wanted to talk about that at all, I think that it would be a really nice resource for a lot of my listeners.
Yeah. So I started a blog in 2020. Yeah, I think it was in 2020. Notes from the Apotheke. So, I was waiting to pronounce it for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I mean, the name comes from originally the blog was conceived of as a ceramics blog, because I work on ceramics in the field, and I was gonna make a whole blog about my work, and then I decided that was not something that super excited me to write about. I mean, I like writing about it in like a scholarly way, but it felt too hard to sustain at the time. And then like all of the Black Lives Matter protests and all of the academic things that happened after that made me want to start a blog about being Black, Indigenous, and persons of color in the field of classics and adjacent fields, and so I created this blog, and it's about my experience as a graduate student, mostly because I was a graduate student when I started it. Now there are some things about being a professor as well, but I'm trying to balance both, still, since it's still fresh and I still have lots of friends that are still in grad school, and I know a lot of graduate students read it. And also, in general, just giving advice to people based on my own experiences of things that I was not taught formally how to do. I had and still have lots of questions about things. So I frequently draw from, yeah, those experiences of frustration and like trying to figure things out. I think more now I ask for inspiration from other people, especially on social media, because I mean, I can't cover everything, of course. So I try to be responsive of what current need is and like what things people in my audience are struggling with. So, yeah, it's been tough keeping up with it these days because starting a new job is a lot. But I still think about it a lot and I'm still writing. I just am trying to find ways to make it sustainable whilst being a professor. And also another thing I forgot that I also do is I try, I've been featuring other scholars of color in the field, mostly because they're interesting and cool and I want to let people know that they exist. But also, you know, just giving students, faculty, like early career faculty, contingent faculty, inspiration for like what is possible in the field. I'm now one of those things that is possible in the field, which is really nice to hear from other people. Actually, someone told me this on Friday that I am proof of what's possible with an archaeology degree from undergrad. So I was like, yeah, that's true. So yeah, so that's kind of like the part of the point of the BIPOC features on the blog as well. So I give advice, but I also like to highlight other scholars in the field that identify as BIPOC, and just so that people in the field, like students especially in the field, don't feel like they're alone and can see what is possible, what can be achieved, because you know there are lots of people out there who are doing some great things and who have made it through what can sometimes be a really tough experience when you are one of the only people of color in your classes, which I was when I was an undergrad. And I know a lot of people still have that experience. So,
yeah, it's a very white field. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, it's a very, very white field. So, and I mean, like, yeah, it's also like a difficult field, I think, with the way things are going, even without like also then being somebody, if you're like in a minority to the point of like, yeah, being like one of the only people of color in a class, like that would be a lot to deal with because it's fucking stressful enough without mm-hmm. adding that. So, you know, like I obviously can only imagine because I'm very white. but like, yeah, like it's like, I mean, just even navigating academia broadly, like there's a huge reason why I didn't continue on. It's just that I like, as somebody who, again, like is very white, but is very neurodivergent and also just didn't feel like I fit into the brain of everybody else. Like, mm-hmm. you know, like, yeah, it's fucking difficult in a field like academia. So it's very nice that you are like providing this, but also like just I think people also just like want to hear that somebody else has had a really similar experience. Yeah. And then, yeah, like, you know, has it become somebody that is like a great example of what you can do with that career and everything. So. It's lovely that you have that and that it's available. And but yeah, no, I think that's like it's a great thing to have. Like, yeah, I don't want to use my own experience because it's obviously not the same. But I also just like even like I went to university like 12 years ago and just like we graduated 12 years ago. Jesus. but just like the difference in terms of like the internet and social media access to other people, I think is so beneficial. And so I just think it's great, especially in the context of being a person of color, BIPOC generally, like of having like an access just to other people is mm-hmm. so huge. And I fucking love social media and just the general internet for that. Like, I think it makes a lot of people a lot less alone. So yeah, I just want to make sure that my listeners know about that. I'm going to link to it in the episode's description.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I definitely feel the same way. I probably would not have ever even begun to consider doing something like this. And it's been like 3 years now and I'm still doing it, which is wild. But yeah, if it hadn't been for, yeah, that first year in 2020, like everybody just kind of banding together on social media and like really starting to come out of not hiding, but like coming out of their shells, I guess, because like I feel like before that like fall of 2020, I did not know anyone else in the field that was a person of color, which is wild because it's like, obviously they were out there, like they don't not exist, but I think once I was like, like does anyone exist, and I like put that out on Twitter, and then like 50 people responded. I was like, oh yeah, like we're out here and we need some more, like we need some cover, like there needs to be more exposure to these people, especially in light of like a lot of really problematic early attempts to do the same thing. I can't tell you how many times I was asked to talk about things that I do not study because I'm just a Black person.
Oh my God.
But yeah, that, I mean, luckily I think people have learned and have stopped asking. But I, yeah, there were a lot of those where I was like, I don't think I am qualified to talk about these things, but thank you for thinking of me.
Like, can I introduce you to the word tokenism? Like,
yeah,
maybe we should do some research. That's wild. Yeah. It's yeah. I mean, 2020, I think, was like a really interesting year, obviously for a lot of reasons, you know, pandemic being a main one, mm-hmm. but I think that it like it's just interesting to hear that that was the year for you, because that was the same year that I got like sort of welcomed into Classics Twitter and mm-hmm. then started talking to people like you. And that has become my favorite thing about the podcast, because just really cool, chill academics want to come on my show. And but 2020 was an interesting year for like, I think, connecting people. And so, you know, obviously it's like a different situation in yours is like finding sort of like a community in this space. And I just think that's generally great. And the internet is fun. And if I keep talking, I'm just going to keep doing my rambling thing where I just go off. So I'm just going to say thank you so much for doing this. This was seriously so much fun. I'm so excited for Nerdy Everyday Life. And it was a joy. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, thanks for having me. And
is there any other things, like I'm going to link to your blog on the episode, but did you want to share any social media or where to follow you just with my listeners at all?
I think the only thing I have left now is Instagram, which is just instagram.com/apothekeyblog. I know my handle is apothekeyblog, but I don't know what the whole link is. But yes, I think that is the only place I actively use anymore. Twitter, whatever it is now, I do not use or check anymore. But yeah, that's the main place I am. I can be found.
I'll
be posting things hopefully more often in 2024, but right now there are lots of resources available for people.
I mean, that's the one thing to remember, like before you, because I've heard you say that a couple of times, like I feel like you feel bad for not posting more, but you've got lots in the back, which is I think a really important thing to remember. Just as somebody who also feels a lot about whether I'm not doing enough, that's why I'm saying that, which is purely out of experience.
Yeah.
But like when people find that stuff, it's so great because they have so much to go through. So it like often feels to you, I think, that you're like, oh no, I haven't done it in a while. But then it's like, oh, you have 3 years that people are discovering. So they've got lots to look at.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. It was very, very fun.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks again for having me.
So happy to. Oh, you wonderful nerds. Thank you all so much for listening. My life has been a complete and utter disaster over the past, I would say, 2 months in various ways, which is why I think the introduction and outro of this sound a little unhinged. Apologies, I was not able to script something ahead of time. So here we are. But the conversation I had with Nadira, that was a little while back now. So I feel like I was a slightly more functioning adult. But truly, this was such a fun conversation. I mean, Nadir and I had fun talking in person, which is why I knew that this would be great. So I'm so grateful to her for coming on and talking about drinking and the Andron. I kind of lost my mind. Utterly fascinating. Oh, and all those little Raitons, Raita. God, they're weird. You should Google them. They're just such a thrill. Honestly, everything about ancient Greek pottery and culture is just wonderful. And the more I get to learn about the everyday lives of just like regular old people, the better. This was the perfect episode for that. So read more from Nadira on her blog, Notes from the Apotheke, which I have linked to in the episode's description and which she taught me to pronounce. Thank you. And also on Instagram, also linked in the episode's description. And for my own selfish reasons, you have a little bit more time to submit questions, comments, character requests, screaming at me for not covering a certain character. You have time to submit those for the New Year Q&A episode. Just head to mythsbaby.com/questions and get them in. I welcome everything. If it's weird or there's some other reason I don't want to read it on the air, that'll be different. But you are welcome to submit it. Thank you all. Let's Talk About Myths Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians, my assistant producer. Laura Smith is now the production assistant and audio engineer. Oh, Laura is wonderful. Michaela's wonderful. I have a great team. It's really cool and nerdy. The podcast is part of the iHeart Podcast Network. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where normally you'll get bonus episodes. I was incapable the past couple of months because I can't even tell you. Like, I just feel like everything is crumbling around me. But things are looking up, hopefully, maybe. Thank you all. I am Liv, and I love this shit. Like, really, everyday people. Oh, my God. Bring me everything there is possibly to learn about them.
Girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.